Okay, so today on the Loopcast, I have Joshua Faust, who's going to sort of help us, guide us through sort of the drone debate. So the debate on this fairly incredibly, you know, not fairly, but incredibly controversial sort of weapon system that has, you know, it's all over in the media. Everybody's talking about it. And you sort of want to, I wanted to have a conversation on drones that was, you know, intelligent, moderate, and not prone to sort of shouting and sort of hyperbole. So before we start, you know, if you're here in DC, Josh is moderating an event at, you know, the American University Washington College of Law at, you know, it's Drone Warfare in 2030, examining the future of expanding drone use, the precedent that it may set, and constitutional implications here and abroad. So I'll have a link for everybody, you know, when the podcast is published. So let me start with, so give us a historic context for the increased use of drones, sort of, you know, from the perspective of the intelligence community and the military, because it seems that drones have been, you know, used since the 90s, and sort of it's only recently in the last, you know, decade or so that, you know, that drone use has sort of ramped up. Sort of help us, guide us through the historic context of, you know, why the increased use of drones.
Okay, yeah, and thanks for having me on here. So as you said, drones have been around since the 90s. They've actually been around in different ways since the 30s. In a very real sense, the V1 and V2 rockets that Germany used against Britain during World War II were drones. The V1s especially, they had engines, they flew like aircraft, and they exploded when they reached their targets. Throughout the Cold War, drones were used for training purposes. In some cases, they were used for surveillance purposes, but for the most part, they were used as airborne targets to help pilots learn how to target things. What happened in the 90s is drones became small enough, and both radio communications and their surveillance gear became sophisticated enough to where they could be used in a persistent way. What this means is that these aircraft could spend long periods of time flying over an area of interest, recording images and then later video that would then get relayed back to a ground station for immediate analysis and at least potentially immediate action. Drones saw the first kind of like combat use, I would say, at least in a way that we would recognize today during the conflict in the Balkans, where they were used to keep track of either different militias or armies, and they didn't have any weapons on them whatsoever. As the 90s progressed, there was this push to put weapons on drones, and kind of the key event for this were the 1998 bombings of both that aspirin factory in Sudan and the Al-Qaeda training camps in Khost province in eastern Afghanistan. Policymakers, the people in the White House, wanted to strike at these places immediately, but what they instead had to do was order up a cruise missile strike from a submarine in the Indian Ocean, and it took so long to get there that by the time the missiles actually arrived, Osama bin Laden had left. So they missed their golden opportunity to get Osama bin Laden before September 11th because their drones that were observing all of this stuff happening didn't have weapons on them. During this same period, the Pentagon was investigating how they could reasonably put weapons on drones. And I actually interviewed a retired three-star general who was responsible for a lot of this process in the 90s. And he told me that they needed these weapons. If they were going to carry weapons, they needed to be extremely precise. And the test that they had to pass was they would have this truck out in the middle of the desert, and they put a watermelon on the dashboard, and the weapon that they fired from this drone had to hit that watermelon, not the truck as a whole, but specifically that watermelon. And they were able to do it. And their conclusion from this was that this was a precise weapon that could be used in combat. So from 1998, it only took about 3 years for this weapon to then be used in combat for the first time. The first targeted kill happened in Afghanistan, in Kabul, in late 2001, and it was against a senior member of Al-Qaeda that some special forces guys had managed to track to a specific house, and a Predator drone flying overhead shot a missile at this guy and killed him. Later in February in 2002, there was another kill of a man on a hillside in again, Khost province in eastern Afghanistan. And only after that, in November of 2002, I think it was November, I hope I don't get called out on that, in Yemen, when a drone was used outside of a war zone to kill people. So pretty early on, the U.S. was using this kind of enhanced capability to go after terrorist targets. But it wasn't the primary way that they went after terrorist targets. Part of it is because armed drones were extremely rare. They just didn't have very many on hand to go do what they wanted it to do. The other one is that they were really unsure about exactly how broadly they could use this weapon system while maintaining legitimacy. As time went on, especially as the weapon proved its effectiveness in Pakistan, drones became more and more common on the battlefield, to the point to where in Libya you actually saw a large number of drones participating in combat, to the point of even replacing manned pilots in such a way that the president could claim that the United States was not actively engaged in hostilities because he was using these drones to strike at targets and no person was being put in danger, so therefore the United States wasn't in combat. Now, there's a lot of kind of loosey-goosey talk that surrounds these, but because of the ease of using these and because of the seeming surgical precision that they present, drones have come to take a greater and greater portion of counterterrorism missions abroad. There are still efforts to capture people. There are still efforts to kill people with more, I guess, conventional means, if that's the right word. But because drones provide this ability to send just a machine with no people in direct danger over a specific target to then monitor for a long period of time someone from the air and then kill him, this has become almost too good to pass up. And so over time, and I'd say most specifically over the last 4 to 5 years, this weapons platform has become really prominent, and you've also seen people reacting against it in response to that.
So, sort of as a question of history, which war is sort of driving this? I mean, is it sort of the war in Iraq, or is it more the war? You've mentioned Afghanistan more than you've mentioned Iraq, and it really seems that, you know, that if you were to compare the two, you know, Afghanistan has. It's not very urban, and it's, you know, you have a lot more sort of, you know, I'll call it unpassable terrain, lots of mountains, lots of hills. And it seems that, you know, that terrain is playing a sort of factor in this, to go back to the question, is the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan driving the use of drones more, or is it more sort of Iraq, or is it really just a combination of the two conflicts?
See, I'd actually say neither. Drones first came to be the weapon of choice in Pakistan, I think, before even they became the weapon of choice inside Afghanistan, and they are being increasingly used inside Afghanistan. To the best that I know, drones have never been used to any great extent in Iraq. They have been in a couple of cases, but they weren't. They haven't replaced manned aircraft the way that they've begun to in Afghanistan and the way that they did from the beginning inside Pakistan. And I'd say even more so than Afghanistan is the politically and physically unpassable terrain of Pakistan is what made drones so intriguing. There's been a lot of reporting recently by Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times about the agreements between the U.S. and Pakistani governments to use drones on their territory. Now, we still don't know for certain whether both sides consider this agreement to still be in effect. Frankly, both governments lie through their teeth about it, so I don't know that either side is particularly trustworthy on it. But we're fairly certain that early on, the United States, George W. Bush, struck an agreement with Pervez Musharraf, and Musharraf admitted this recently on CNN, to allow the use of drones to go after al-Qaeda targets inside Pakistan. There were a number of reasons behind this decision. One is that the U.S. could not be seen to be openly operating in Afghanistan. From a political perspective, that was unacceptable to Musharraf. The second part of this is that the United States didn't want to risk people dying inside Pakistan because, again, the politics of that would have just been extraordinary to deal with, and it seemed it wasn't worth the time and effort to put that together. At the same time, these drones, like I said in the first question, offered this combination of capabilities that was extremely attractive. They not only could fly in like a regular aircraft, they could stay for hours and hours and hours without needing to refuel, without the pilot needing to get up and go pee, without needing to eat. And because of that, they essentially took over the counterterrorism mission inside Pakistan. As a result, a senior counterterrorism official actually told me this several months ago. He said, I don't think that we have the means to carry out a capture operation like we did against Khaled Sheikh Mohammed in 2002, because we've invested so much of our time, energy, and effort into flying these drones. So I'm paraphrasing him, obviously, but there's this strong sense that that use of drones in Pakistan has been what has clarified the use of drones everywhere else. I think we've seen that reflected a little bit in how different the drone war is in Yemen than it is in Pakistan. In Pakistan, there is this implicit agreement, and you can actually find these in some of the leaked State Department cables, that the Pakistani government would publicly disavow all knowledge of the drone program in response for allowing the drone program to continue. This comes back to that political issue with allowing the U.S. to strike at Pakistani territory. It's going to inflame tensions. Everyone knew it, and so they took steps to foster all of the blame and all of the public outcry on the United States while excusing the Pakistani government. In Yemen, on the other hand, while President Saleh, who used to run the country before 2012, made that same goal, there was never that same sense of double talking about it. Everyone assumed that he had given permission, in part because there was already a sizable special operations presence in the country training their counterterrorism unit. And that's become even more explicit under President Hadi, where he's even said publicly in front of the United Nations, "I love drones," or something to that effect. So the U.S. even, I think, has internalized this lesson from Pakistan that operating it entirely in secret is kind of a non-starter. They need to get the public support of a host government to allow the politics of drones to not overwhelm the mission that the drones are supposed to carry out. So I hope that that answers the question, but I would really place the center, the origin of the drone war as we now envision it, as being in Pakistan and not in definitely not in Iraq and probably not in Afghanistan.
That's good. So let's sort of, before getting into sort of the strategic and policy questions, you know, what is the legal framework, you know, that has sort of accompanied this historic framework? You know, is
yeah. Well, we don't know what a lot of the legal framework is. There's a big question about this. We keep hearing about these Office of Legal Counsel memos or white papers that supposedly lay out the legal reasoning that the administration has used to justify these drone strikes. Most of them are classified. Most of them, I believe, have been handed over to the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, but they haven't been released publicly and they haven't been declassified yet. The only one that we've gotten any access to is a single OLC white paper that lays out part of the government's legal reasoning it uses to justify targeting American citizens, not foreign citizens, but only American citizens. And there, they build their legal authority to carry out these strikes on three pillars. One is the authorization for the use of military force, which authorized the president, the White House, to carry out attacks globally against anyone involved with the groups who planned and carried out the 9/11 attacks. The second one is the inherent right to self-defense contained in international law. So because Al-Qaeda has attacked the United States and is continuing to try to attack the United States, therefore the United States is given the right to defend itself from that attack. And the third one is the president's inherent authority in Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution to defend the country as commander-in-chief of its armed forces. All three of those reasons on their own would be sufficient to go after these groups. I think by presenting them in parallel like that, what the administration is saying, in effect, is that there are a lot of reasons, so many reasons, that give them permission to go after these groups that it really shouldn't be questioned. The problem with that kind of foundational reasoning is that the way the drone strikes have been carried out raise an awful lot of questions. In particular, even going against American citizens, when they say that they go after American citizens and they prefer to capture if they can't kill and they only kill as a last resort, their actual behavior in relation to these strikes make me think that that's not entirely accurate, that they'll kill if they can, but they won't really go out of their way for it. But there are a number of other legal issues surrounding it. Honestly, that's a separate podcast probably. But the drone program as a whole is facing increasing legal questions, not just about the decision to strike at American citizens, but about whether the president has the right to strike against even certain kinds of groups. So the AUMF authorizes the president to go after the people who planned and carried out the September 11th attacks. But we also know that drone strikes have happened against groups and individuals that had nothing to do with 9/11. So that raises a lot of, I think, really important questions about the legal foundation and the legal authorization behind this drone war that need to be answered by the administration and just haven't been.
Sort of moving away from sort of the AUMF and towards, you know, how does this work at the agency level? I mean, it seems like, you know, you have the intelligence agencies, the intelligence community, you have the military, and then you also have sort of the State Department. So
yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, this seems to be Title 10, Title 50, and Title 22. I mean, how does this sort of all work as a, you know, not just, you know, away from the AUMF and sort of at the agency level?
Yeah, I mean, I'd actually describe it as a Title 82 issue, meaning it combines Title 10, Title 50, and Title 22. So just to clarify that a bit, we're talking about different kinds of national security authorizations. One governs the armed forces, one governs the intelligence community, and the other governs kind of statecraft, diplomacy, State Department type issues, and all of the other things that flow from that. And this is not a really easy question to answer. Military units like JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, can operate under either Title 10 or Title 50, meaning they can be performing either intelligence functions or military functions. And the administration, both under Bush and Obama, has kind of played games with this, where when, say, an Armed Services Committee has said, hey, JSOC is doing this, we need to know about it, they've said, well, wait a minute, they're performing intelligence functions, so you as the Armed Services Committee can't get access to this. And then when the Intelligence Committee says, hey, they're doing intelligence work, we need to know what they are, the administration then says, well, wait, they're doing military work, so you don't actually get to ask about this. So there's a bit of a gray area where all of these things kind of come together at the same time that can make it really difficult to disentangle. In a general broad sense, in Pakistan, at least, the CIA, quote-unquote, owns the drones, meaning that they were responsible for acquiring the drones, they paid for them, they pay for their operation. They also own the intelligence that goes into the drones, so they're responsible for collecting, analyzing, vetting, and then publishing the targeting packages that go into identifying who gets killed by these drone strikes. But the U.S. Air Force flies the drones, so their pilots are the ones physically physically flying the planes to take off, and then they're the ones who pull the trigger. And in all of this, this is a recent revelation, the ambassador in Pakistan is supposed to have the final say over who gets hit and who doesn't get hit. In Yemen, it's muddier because we don't know how often the CIA flies drones. We don't know how often JSOC flies drones. In Pakistan, the CIA is the only agency that authorizes drone strikes. The military doesn't. That's a strictly intelligence operation. In Yemen, both do. And again, without having more understanding of the laws governing these strikes, I don't think we really have the means to say which agency is carrying out what. And frankly, it's the very confused nature of this that I think makes people get so not uptight, but just get really skeptical about the entire operation, because so much of it is taking place in the shadows. There's just no reasonable way to hold the government accountable for what it's doing.
That's interesting. So let us sort of switch over and sort of examine sort of an operational and tactical framework for the use of drones. So, you know, are there sort of operational and tactical commonalities between Pakistan, Yemen, and Afghanistan? And sort of, moreover, has this framework between the three theaters been successful? I mean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think from an operational perspective, and I'm not sure that that's even the right word for this, in terms of how drones tend to function, within agencies, they tend to function the same way. So the CIA tends to use drones in the same way wherever they operate, just with differing levels of permission and oversight in different theaters. In Pakistan, they have a relatively free hand. The military actually has fairly established rules of engagement for how it uses drones. Basically, it treats them like any other kind of aircraft. So they need to have defined targets in place. They need to have, at least for pre-planned strikes, so strikes that are not done under close air support but are actually part of a deliberate targeted action, they need to have JAG approval. They actually get held responsible for when strikes go wrong to different degrees. It's not like they get thrown up against a wall. So, you know, that's a bit more of a loaded question, I think, than you realize you're asking. Tactically, also, drones get used in very different ways. In Afghanistan, in a lot of ways, drones are replacing conventional aircraft as the primary mechanism for accomplishing air sorties. In Yemen, they're used more as close air support for the Yemeni army and also as a first strike option against terrorist targets. In Pakistan, they're used exclusively as a first strike option against terrorist targets. Drones are in Pakistan, at least, drones are only there to kill to kill terrorists, for lack of a better term. I mean, there's, like I said, there's a lot of wiggle room behind this, and I don't want to get tied down to saying that's really what they're doing. But within each agency, they don't operate that differently across theaters, as far as we know. But each theater actually uses drones in a different way.
So, sort of integrate into your answer, sort of signature strikes versus targeted strikes. I mean, we hear a lot about this, and sort of, first, sort of give us a definition of what a signature strike is and what a targeted strike is, because it seems like the two phrases are really bandied about and sort of without a clear definition. I sort
They
of.
don't. And you know, in a way, they're almost obsolete because I don't think those are the terms the administration uses for them anymore. I don't know what targeted strikes are called anymore. Signature strikes, though, are now called terrorist attack disruption strikes, or at least they were most recently, TADS. I'm not really sure why they keep changing terminology for it. I mean, but it's just something the government likes to do. I mean, when I worked on Afghanistan issues, almost every other month they would come up with a new name for the insurgency. And they would all be different acronyms that just no one really cared about all that much. So, but at a basic idea, like you're right, there are two different types of strikes. One is a targeted strike or a deliberate strike. It's where an individual on the ground or even a small group of people are positively identified, meaning that a number of different pieces of intelligence have indicated that they would be there and their presence has been confirmed either visually or through some other kind of electronics or signals means, like their cell phone got tracked, something like that. But basically, it's a multi-source confirmation that a specific person or specific group is in a specific place at a specific time. When all of that comes together, then a strike can be ordered. Usually, those strikes get ordered very quickly because just the threshold for that kind of a strike is high enough to where there's confidence in the system that they're getting the right person. The other kind are these signature strikes or TADS, where the reason they're called signature strikes or were called signature strikes is because it was believed that people engaging in militancy, so engaging in terrorism that would threaten the United States in some way, had a specific signature, meaning they engaged in a certain discrete set of behaviors that on their own would indicate intent and danger for attacking the United States. Based on that evidence alone, and we don't have a solid idea of what that signature is, whether it's people in a desert firing machine guns, whether it's a bunch of people crowded around a computer screen in someone's house. We don't know exactly what goes into this signature. But if someone meets this signature threshold, then even if we cannot positively identify who they are, so if we don't know who they are, then they can still be targeted and fired on. The result of this is that there's a large but unknown number of people in both Yemen and Pakistan who have been killed, deliberately shot at by the United States, but whose identities we cannot confirm. So we don't know if they were terrorists or if they were just innocent people being caught up in bad circumstance. That, I think, is the real danger of the signature strike policy, is that because we don't actually know the identities of the people that we're targeting for death, and we don't actually know whether they belong to a certain group, whether they have specific intentions, because we can't identify them, we don't actually know if they qualify for being legitimate targets of violence.
So then, let me ask you a sort of question. And then
Yeah.
has, this been successful then? I mean, in terms of this approach, in terms of, degrading networks and sort of, making it more costly for, these organizations to, organize. I mean,
Yeah.
or has this approach been, completely unsuccessful?
I'm going to give an annoying academic sounding cop out and say it depends.
Okay.
When you look at what the CIA's specific mission in Pakistan is to do, which is to go after Al-Qaeda, attack them as a group, as a network, and degrade their capacity to attack the United States, it's been stunningly successful. But if you broaden your lens a little bit and say, is Pakistan better off as a result of this campaign? Is the United States as a whole better off, not just from the limited attack that Al-Qaeda could provide, but from all of the other militant groups and instability in Pakistan, are we better off as a result? Is Afghanistan, the country that we actually claim to really care about in South Asia, is Afghanistan better off as a result? Then the question becomes a lot harder to answer. And I think you can see the same thing in Yemen. Drone strikes have been effective at getting a lot of people who are members of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They've also come at a cost, and that cost has been enabling an abusive and somewhat unpopular regime, although that's changed a little bit with Hadi in charge. It's not as bad as it was under Saleh. But also, we don't actually know that Yemen is being made into a better place as a result of these strikes. And the downside to this is that if either country kind of falls over this cliff into a permanent or generational state of persistent and violent anti-Americanism, I don't think it's a clear-cut case to say that the United States has benefited from the use of these weapons. No matter the success that it's had going after these bad guys, going after these terrorists, if it comes at the cost of, say, losing Pakistan for a decade, I don't think that the people can really say that that trade is worth it just glibly. It takes a lot of argument and a lot of consideration to really work through that. So the kind of catchphrase that I use to answer that is from a tactical perspective, yeah, they're great. They do really, really well. But from a strategic perspective, they have a lot that they need to answer for, and those answers haven't come yet.
Okay, so walk us through the sort of, is there a strategic framework? I mean, it seems like sort of your answer points to, you know, it's very good at killing, but not very good at sort of strategy and sort of policy. I mean, sort of walk us through, you know, is there a strategic framework and, you know, is there an attempt to develop one?
I mean, the administration would insist that it has a strategic framework. They'd say that they have this whole policy for going after terrorists and that these strikes are only one part of it. In fact, when you break it down into a country level, in both Pakistan and Yemen, what government officials point to are the huge budgets they spend on aid, the huge budgets they spend on humanitarian relief, economic development, governance assistance. And in the case of Yemen, at least, that money outweighs the amount that they spend on military stuff inside the country. The problem is that when ordinary people look at what the United States does and what the most visible aspect of their presence is, what they see are drones or the military or something violent. And that's the part that I think really, really causes problems. So while there might be this overall strategy, I don't think there's evidence that that strategy is really working.
Okay, so I'm gonna sort of switch gears just a little and sort of, you know, we talked about the frameworks in a very sort of general manner, and now I'm curious, you know, where do we put the human element in this framework? You know, it, you know, not just from the perspective of, you know, somebody writing a strategy or a policy, but also, you know, how has the drone, in the use of drones sort of changed, you know, how we do collection, how we do analysis, and whether, you know, is the drone war really, you know, is it as driven by drones as we think it is, or, you know, it there's more of a human element. Sort of walk us through the human element.
John Brennan actually answered this when he was being vetted by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence to run the Central Intelligence Agency. He actually said that he thinks the CIA has become too focused on killing and has drifted away from its core competency of collecting and analyzing human intelligence. That's the guy who's right now running the CIA, and he said that just 2 months ago. So I've been arguing for a long time that the intelligence community has actually become too enamored of drones, and more broadly, too enamored of this idea of identifying and killing people in an almost industrial way, that they've lost the ability to understand and contextualize human and social information about the countries that they care about. So, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether or not the human side of things is expanding, properly funded, properly prioritized. I mean, I don't think that's terribly fruitful to get into because there's often nowhere to go with it. But to me, the kind of signal marker idea here is that the man currently running the Central Intelligence Agency told Congress, told the Senate that that agency had become too focused on killing and had lost its needed focus on human factors.
So then, sort of not thinking of the drone as a killing machine, but as a collection machine, it seems that, you know, every time I read an article about how much, you know, data one drone hoovers up, you know, and I use the, you know, the verb hoover and sort of the image of a vacuum as,
yeah.
You know, I think it's pertinent because it really seems, you know, when you read through these, you know, these papers or articles, it really seems that a single drone could produce a lot of information. And then, but, you know, when you have 80 hours of footage, but you only have one analyst to deal with it. I mean,
that's actually a huge issue. And we should all even break that down a little bit. So drones can collect visual imagery. They can collect infrared imagery. They can also be equipped with something called MASINT or MASINT packages, which is measurement and signals intelligence, measurement and signatures intelligence. And that's a type of collection I frankly don't understand all that well. And I worked for 6 years in the intelligence community, and I still would have a hard time defining that. But they can collect an awful lot of information only looking at the kind of video that they collect. If you have a predator with kind of a normal IR and visual surveillance package, it'll fly for around 20 to 40 hours over its target collecting this video. Not all of that gets watched at once. I remember there being a statistic recently that there's something like 12,000 hours of video being produced from drones every month. And that's just an unfathomable amount. I might be wrong on that. It had the number 12 in it though, and it was very large. So these drones are producing so much information, we physically lack the means to analyze it with the people that we currently have. Drones also aren't collecting all of the information that we need. They can give us pictures from the air. They can't give us audio. They can't give us any sense of intent. They're really bad at reading body language because from the air, there's only so much you can read from someone about their face, about the way their shoulders are hunched. So they produce a lot of information, but it's limited. It's incomplete information.
I was going to ask, how is this different than spy planes of, you know, a generation ago? Because it seems like, you know, this question might come off as trolling, but it really seems that, you know, the drone as an intelligence collection machine isn't really that different than a spy plane, except for, with the exception being in terms of sheer mass and, you know, sheer quantity of information.
Right. That's one part of it. Functionally, I don't think they're different. And when people ask about whether drones are illegal to fly, I mean, that's something I do kind of laugh at because it's not like because the pilot is somewhere else that suddenly different laws apply to it. I mean, it's a spy plane. Ultimately, it's a spy plane that can shoot at things on occasion. The big difference between the current drone and either satellite imagery or, say, like a U-2 spy plane or a C-12, something like that, is that it collects a huge amount of video. And those other platforms tend to collect either signals or pictures. So it's this full motion video that has really revolutionized how people perceive of the intelligence that they can collect and understand about something as it's unfolding. There's an enormous effort underway inside both DARPA and in other kinds of acquisitions programs to automate the video analysis so that they don't have to hire tens of thousands of people to crawl through all of this footage and pick out significant events. But analyzing video is a hell of a lot harder than analyzing a single picture. I mean, a video ultimately is just thousands of pictures strung together in sequence. So that's stillborn. And until that computer capacity catches up with the backlog of information that we've collected through these drones, you're going to still see that weird dichotomy between where most of what drones actually record doesn't ever get seen by a human.
So, I mean, in terms of costs then, you know,
yeah.
Let me ask you as a general sort of framing question. What are the budgetary concerns with the use of drones? Because, you know, usually the argument that we hear is, you know, drones are cheaper or, you know, the use of a drone program is cheaper than, let's say, F-16s, F-22s, you know, traditionally manned planes. But it seems like in your, you know, the way you answered the previous question, it really seems that you're not just paying for the plane, the analyst, and sort of the guy in maintenance, but you're also paying for, you know, hard drive storage, bandwidth, etc. So,
right.
So lead us through sort of the budgetary concerns.
There are different kinds of drones, just like how there are different kinds of aircraft. And each of those drones has a different price point. The most common drone that we think of, the Predator, the MQ-1 Predator, is fairly cheap. It only costs a couple of million dollars to make, but it requires something like 168 people to operate. That includes the people who fly it, the people who maintain it, the people who handle all the logistics set up with giving it a nearby base, refueling it, and then trying to analyze the information that it sends back. Newer drones like the MQ-1C or the RQ-4 Global Hawk are actually much more expensive. Those start costing dozens of millions of dollars. Or in the case of the RQ-4, I think that costs $100 million. That's when you start getting into F-22 range with your price. Moreover, their operating costs and their development costs are so high that in some cases they can actually be more expensive to operate than the current fifth generation manned fighters that the Air Force is flying. This isn't a hard and fast rule. An F-15, say, is going to be much cheaper to assign and then fly than one of these aircraft, just because it's old and fairly simple and we know how to make it function. But for all of the newer drones coming online, they're going to cost a lot more money to develop. And to kind of back up a bit, this MQ-1 Predator drone is more or less pieced together from fairly mundane off-the-shelf components. Newer drones that are being developed, like the X-47B, which is supposed to take off and land from aircraft carriers, are going to be incredibly complicated and built from scratch with these bespoke, customized components. That costs a lot of money. Contractor companies are sinking millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars into the development of these systems. The Pentagon is starting to throw really, really big money at developing these systems. All of that is going to get amortized over the life cycle of these drones as they come out. And with newer drones being made out of custom components requiring much greater capacity to maintain and fly, you're going to see prices skyrocket. So while drones, I describe them as offering a modest price savings over most current manned aircraft. That doesn't mean that they're not worth flying, but I think there is this kind of urban myth that drones are this really, really cheap, easy way to get eyes in the sky over something.
Now, in terms of sort of like the people who are maintaining and developing these drones, I mean, are they employees of the government? Do they work for, you know, an intelligence agency or the military? Or are we talking about sort of more contractors and sort of, you know?
I mean, for the most part, we're talking about contractors. Drones are designed and built just like any other military aircraft. So the government comes up with a set of requirements. It then asks industry to fulfill those requirements. It holds a competition to see who offers them the most attractive package of price, features, and performance, and then they get to build a drone based off of that award. And you know, this comes back to just like with spy planes, they don't function differently from any other kind of military equipment that's out there. They're just used differently in the field.
So now, sort of, is this sort of like the technology that goes into the technology and the budgetary concerns that go into this? Is it more? You mentioned that, you know, some of the low-end ones you could just build from civilian components or, you know, not civilian but off the shelf. And then some of the more custom-built, you know, they have to go to the company and sort of have it built by the company. So I'm curious, you know, in terms of acquisition, you know, which way, you know, is the government going? I mean, do they really prefer – is there a preference for more sort of custom-built sort of, you know, unique – sort of drones, or, you know, more about mass purchasing and getting, you know, the cheapest and most off the shelf device, you know, system that they can? Or is it like a combination?
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure how to answer that. Before sequestration, I would have said the government wanted all the expensive drones. That's been moderated a little bit. The U.S. Air Force just recently stood down an entire squadron, a Reserve Air National Guard squadron that was assigned to fly RQ-4 Global Hawk drones, which are the big jet-powered, like 737-sized drones that do long-duration flights. Part of it is also military necessity. As the wars wind down, drone purchases are slowing down. But long term, it's a mixture. Because drones are so labor intensive to operate, the military really can't just buy millions of them willy-nilly and fling them into the skies and hope for the best. They actually do have to be very deliberate about specific mission profiles and specific logistical burdens that come with operating these drones. I'd say in the real world, we're going to see a mixture of the two in the long run. Just like with aircraft, most of the aircraft that we fly tend to be conventional, kind of boring third and fourth generation aircraft, and we have a small number of hyper advanced fifth generation birds like the F-22 or the F-35 that get all of the attention and glory because they're pretty and sexy and new, but really don't represent the bulk of the aircraft that we fly. We're going to see the same thing with drones. Most of the drones that get flown today are really cheap, almost disposable, and are cobbled together out of off-the-shelf components. That doesn't mean that there will be zero custom or really high-tech, high-specialization drones in the future. Just that I don't think those are going to represent most of what we see flying.
That's okay. So, let's maybe switch gears one more time and sort of, I've noticed, in our conversation, the use of drones is always in the context of CT, of counterterrorism, degrading networks and sort of violent non-state actors. So I'm curious, where do we put the state in all this? Because it seems like, one of the most more famous examples is that, Iran downed a drone. And, Iran is a relatively stable state with lots of, anti-aircraft weapons. I'm assuming they have a lot of anti-aircraft weapons. And sort of also, the conversation with Syria, at the beginning of the conflict, there was a push, to have, at least argumentatively, there was a push to have drones involved in Syria. And, the counter-argument was, well, Syria has a robust set of anti-aircraft weapons, So I'm curious then, how can we apply this to Pakistan and Yemen? Because it seems like I'm assuming Pakistan and Yemen still have anti-aircraft weapons and can control their airspace. So then, how do we relate, the state and the imperative of the state to sort of guard its airspace versus the use of drones? I mean, it seems,
You're actually touching on one of my biggest pet peeves about the drone debate in Pakistan, which is the claim that drones violate Pakistan's sovereignty and violate their airspace. Frankly, if Pakistan wanted to shoot down an American drone, it could do so without trying very hard, because the drones that we fly over Pakistan, the MQ-1 and the MQ-9, are slow-moving, low-flying, propeller-driven aircraft that give off a huge radar signature, are very easy to track, and have no defenses whatsoever. Same thing in Yemen. So drones are a great thing to use in a permissive environment where political sensitivities make one reluctant to risk, say, a pilot flying overhead. Or in somewhere like northern Mali, where unarmed drones are used to generate surveillance. They're a great choice there. Mali has no real air defenses in the northern part of its country, so it's relatively easy to fly drones there, and there's a remote chance they'll get shot down by insurgents, but if they do, there's no pilot in it, so it's okay. If we're talking about somewhere like Syria, the Syrian military could shoot drones out of the sky without thinking about it. Iran can shoot drones out of the sky without thinking about it. And every time that we try to fly drones right along the boundary of their national waters, they send jets out to escort the drones to let us know that they're keeping an eye on them. So in a general sense, drones are so easy to shoot down that whenever they get used, it really can only happen with the consent of the host government.
Now, I'm curious then, I mean, is there any push or any thought being, offered to sort of move? It really just seemed that the drones are really a product of, unconventional warfare and counterterrorism and, counterinsurgency. And really, if there's ever a more, I'm putting this in quotes, a more conventional war, that drones wouldn't, there'd be sort of a switching back to traditional planes. So, I mean, is there thought being given to sort of, integrating drones into a more, quote, conventional setting, or is it, or drones really just tied to this sort of unconventional warfare, counterterrorism sort of context?
I think in kind of a broad sense, that's up in the air. There is a useful battlefield usage profile for drones, but they're not a panacea for everything. They don't solve all of the problems that you have on a battlefield. Just like in an intelligence setting, they're useful for doing some things, but they don't solve all programs. I think what the government is trying to do is to keep as many options on the table as it can to use these weapons, these surveillance platforms in the future without really trying to limit itself about what it can use them for. I know that sounds like kind of a cop-out answer to this, but from a doctrine perspective, they're still figuring out exactly how to use them and the most effective way to use them. So in many ways, it's still just a big question mark.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've sort of arrived at the end of the conversation. Do you have anything else you want to mention? I mean, I feel like we've covered a lot.
Yeah, I mean, we've actually covered the contents of a book. So, I mean, yeah, like from an overview perspective, I think this is hitting on all the important parts. There's so much to discuss and understand about these. I mean, drones present a technological challenge. They present an ethical challenge, a political challenge, a legal challenge, an intelligence challenge, an international relations challenge. I mean, there are so many different areas that this single platform touches on. I mean, you almost have a limitless supply of topics and perspectives that you can discuss it from.
Thank you. So before we end, just remember, if you're here in DC, Josh is moderating Drone Warfare in 2030, Examining the Future of Expanding Drone Use, the Precedent That May Set, and Constitutional Implications Here and Abroad. I'll put the link up. So if you're here in DC, it's a lunchtime event. It's basically will probably be really good. So please go check it out. And thank you so much for coming on, Josh.
Absolutely. Thanks. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you.